Thanks for inviting us to the party. Parties are good. We like parties. And congratulations to everybody who worked hard all year to get the awards. Right now, I'm the only thing standing in the way of you getting them, so let me do what I do, and then the good stuff happens. I have three things that I want to do today. First of all, I have a story to tell you. It's kind of an historical type story. Then I'm going to offer you a short handful of New Year's resolutions as pertains to your riding. And finally, I have a one-question quiz. And if you fall asleep during the first two parts, it doesn't matter because the quiz isn't related to them. So you still have a chance to do well in that, okay? So I want to start kind of maybe at an odd place with a very quick baseball anecdote. There was a guy who came into the major leagues when I was growing up. His name was Frank Robinson. A very, very accomplished African-American ball player, a contemporary of Hank Aaron or Willie Mays. Started in 56. He was Rookie of the Year that year. Played for 20 seasons. Was in the All-Star Game 14 of those seasons. One of three people since 1960 to win the Triple Crown, which is a big deal in baseball. He's the only person ever to have been MVP in both leagues. He retired with 586 home runs, which at that point was fourth most on the all-time list. He was the first African-American manager in the major leagues. He was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, and he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. So this kind of a heavy-duty guy in that sport. Well, so a few years later, while he was managing, it was kind of a rainy late morning. It was end of spring, beginning of summer. And the team's all sitting around in the clubhouse waiting to see if the rain will stop and they'll have a game that day. And a kid, a rookie, fresh-faced, fuzzy-cheeked guy, sits down on the stool next to Robinson to try to make conversation with his boss and begins, So Skip, tell me, you ever play any ball? Well, that isn't a good way to ingratiate yourself to your employer, but it does point out that very often when we take up a new sport, there's a tendency to think its history began about the time you began to do it. Maybe a few years before that, because your friends tell you a little bit. But that happens in riding also. And so I want to tell you about one notable person today that if you aren't aware of him, you should be. Now, we all know of a few people in the history of equestrian sport. Most of you probably have at least heard of Xenophon. That's the X guy. And maybe you've heard of Lagernière, 1751, invented shoulder in and all that. But this is much more recent. This guy is Bert DeNemethy. Is that a name that means something to some of you? Well, Bert DeNemethy, we could argue, was the most important person in the history of American show jumping in the entire second half of the 20th century. Really big deal. He was the first civilian coach of the USET show jumping squad. You may know that back not long before that, including the 48 Olympics, the only way you could compete in Olympic equestrian sports was to first of all be a guy, second be in the military, and third be an officer, or you, no matter how good you weren't allowed to play. Well, that changed in the 52 games. DeNemethy became the coach in 55, and he did that for 25 years. And during the 25 years, he coached the USET. The team won at the Olympic Games at various times, gold, silver, and bronze medals in both team and individual. He also presided over 72 Nations Cup wins. And among the people that he himself coached and mentored were names like George Morris, Bill Steinkraus, Frank and Mary Chapeau, Kathy Kusner, Carol Hoffman, Neil Shapiro, Melanie Smith, Buddy Brown, Joe Farages, Conrad Homefeld, Katie Monahan, and some others I probably am not remembering. So anyway, really, really, really big deal, this guy. But it wasn't just how successful he was that was important. It was his methods. Because back in the early 50s, show jumping in the U.S. was way different than now. Most of the courses were in little rings. They were big, tall fences, but really simple courses. Once and a half around and down the middle was kind of normal for show jumping back then. And obviously, if you see current day Olympics or World Cup competition in jumping, the courses are much more intricate with a grab and a bank and a ditch and an open water and all these sorts of things that are way more interesting and involved. That wasn't the case back then. Dedemethy was born in 1911 in Hungary. He joined the cavalry, ended up teaching at the Royal Hungarian Cavalry School, came to the U.S. right after World War II, got a job up on the North Shore of Boston, riding for Eleanora Sears, who had fancy horses and lots of money. It was that same Sears family that's going out of business now. And anyway, the thing about his training was, other than what happened at Fort Riley and a few places like that, he used dressage. And that wasn't what show jumpers used to do back then. Show jumpers back then were really pretty hit and miss and seat of the pants and made it up as they went along. But he schooled his horses systematically on the flat with suppling exercises, with lateral movements, with many transitions, with the things that now we know are pretty standard, but they weren't so standard back then. And when he schooled the horses over fences, he did gymnastics, cavalletti, those grids and athletic exercises for horses. Again, pretty standard, but not so standard back then. So a friend of mine saw him at a show back in 1952 or 53. It was in Medfield, Mass., and it was one of his first times out with his horses. And she said, the day before at the show, as he started to school, the local professionals just stopped what they were doing and looked at it and elbowed each other and essentially laughed at him, made fun of it, poked each other and pointed and made catcalls. And of course, the deal is that only lasted until he started beating them all like crazy, which is what he did. And so we can be mindful of all the things he did that really have changed show jumping for the good and made it much more popular than it was back then. So when you read someone's resume, it seems kind of dry and antiseptic, but I had the good fortune to have met Dedemethy a handful of times. And I just wanted to tell you a little bit, because all these people in the books were real people. First time I met him was in, I guess it was 73, and it was at the height of his success. He was world famous as a jumper trainer, and he was invited to the American Dressage Institute to give a several-week-long course for selected, invited, advanced riders in dressage. I was not one of them. I was a very novice-like person. I was there riding with the staff, just trying to figure out what the sport was. But I was able to watch him. And on the last Thursday evening he was there, there was a cookout for him. And as the embers died down, he got up to speak a little bit. And I remember how humble he was and how grateful he said he was that people took his knowledge of dressage seriously. They didn't just think he was some jumper guy who won a lot of ribbons, but he was proud that he was doing it the right way for the benefit of the horses. And that was very impressive, the way he spoke that night. Another time, a few years later, I was at Gladstone, which was the team headquarters, and I had wheedled a little scholarship to ride with Colonel Ljungquist and Colonel Summer. This was right after the Montreal Olympics. But that was Dedemethy's home base. And I'd go out early in the morning to loosen my horse up a little bit. And in that great ring in front of the magnificent stables, Dnemathy would be out there quietly schooling one of the jumpers on the flat. And he could have totally ignored me, or he could have been annoyed that I interfered with his solitude, but he was the most gracious person you could imagine. And I mean, I was nobody, but he made me feel, maybe not like somebody, but at least that an important person would bother to care. And that was very touching also, because he behaved exactly the way you wish famous people would behave. And one more time, back at ADI, someone else conducting a course at the same time Dnemathy was there was a New York ballet master named Robert Thibodeau. Thibodeau was teaching a studio course on body control and development, and you'd stand in front of the mirrors at the bar and you would learn positions and breathing and alignment and so on. And then you'd carry the same things over onto the lunge line later in the day, and then when you were actually schooling your horse, you'd be reminded of the same things. Well, every morning, Dnemathy would come in and he'd greet Bob Thibodeau, "Good morning, Mr. Tippy Toes." And Thibodeau would shoot right back at him, "And good morning to you, Sir Captain Divinity." So anyhow, there are lots of other people of equal interest, men and women, that have done a lot to make our sport what it is and understandable. And I think it's just interesting and important every now and then to look back and track down one or another of them and remember what they did. So, all right, now we get to the resolutions. And before we do that, I have to inject a tiny little bit more about baseball, because you may know that typically, even in the major leagues, when a ball player goes up to bat, he fails about three quarters of the time. And if he's good enough that he can average just three hits out of every 10 times at bat over the course of his career, he's pretty likely to get into the Hall of Fame. That's important, because that means a baseball player, to be successful, has to deal with adversity, has to deal with failure, has to recognize it's part of the way things are, live with it, deal with it, move on, don't get dragged down by it. And that has to do with the dressage New Year's resolutions I'm about to present to you, all right? So the first one has two parts. It's to avoid what I would want you to think of as the amateur's affliction. And the first part of that is where you look at videos of yourself and you feel guilty because you don't ride as well as Isabel Vert or Charlotte Dujardin or Laura Graves or somebody. My horse deserves better than I. How can I possibly do this? Oh, woe is me. Well, yeah. So remember, they also have looked at videos of themselves when they were younger and probably said much the same thing, because everybody says stuff like that. And what I'd have you think is, while I would assume that along the way you will become better riders and your position will improve and so on, that's what we do, but in the meantime, you can't just ride around worrying about your elbows. You have to school your horse. And if you don't have the best tools yet to school your horse, you got to school it with the tools you have. If you were washed up on a desert island, you couldn't really sit around and bemoan the fact that there's no plug for your skill saw. You get a coconut husk, you get a piece of driftwood, you get a palm frond and a rock or two, and you build with what you've got until you've got better stuff to build with. And that's exactly the same when we ride. The other part of the amateur's affliction is this business of thinking of your horse as a pet. Now, I want you to love your horse. That's all fine. That's good. You can kiss him on the nose. You can give him treats. You can even sit in the stall in the evening and read stories to him. All that's excellent. I'm in favor of that. But the way horses look at affection is a little bit different than we do. They're not like house cats. And you have to have in your mind that a big part of your relationship with your horse, if you're going to be successful, has to do with respect. Okay? A woman came up to me once, and she said she wanted advice about whom she could have ride her horse, but she didn't want a strong rider on her horse. And I said, well, no, you're wrong. You do want a strong rider on your horse. You just don't want a rider who uses her strength all the time. Strong riders are, if they're any good, keep most of that strength in reserve. It's like a potential. They use as much as they need when they need to, and the rest of the time they don't. They get a reaction, good. If they don't get a reaction, they get a little stronger. Reaction, reward. Strength goes away. The horse begins to learn to respond to lighter and lighter aids as you go along. That's the way it's supposed to be. So a strong rider who uses her strength all the time makes the horse dull or resentful, and you certainly don't want that. But you do want to be a strong rider. That's a good rider. A friend of mine who teaches tells her students that same thing in a slightly different way. She says, when you ride, you must never be mean to your horse. But when you ride your horse, you have to mean it. Okay? Now, next resolution comes from another person whom I teach. And she is a lovely lady. She's a little bit on the passive side. She tends to think if anything goes wrong, it's her fault. The horse pins an ear or doesn't move over or hollows in a transition or something, and she backs off. And it wouldn't matter that much, except she has pretensions to do third level, and that's not how you get to third level, believe me. Well, fortunately, she has other interests, so I was able to go to one of those to try to explain to her how she should react to when her horse does these various things. Susanna is kind of the perfect mom, and she has a couple of kids, and she drives them around to every conceivable thing that they need to do after school, and she's a good cook. And I said, so Susanna, do you make Sunday dinner for your family sometimes? Yes. Well, so imagine that you've made a nice rib roast for them, and it's one of those times where the whole family's together, and as the roast comes out of the oven, you're making pan gravy. And it looks rich and thick and delicious, smells great. And you put it in the gravy boat, and you put it on the table. And as they start to ladle it out, half-congealed lumps of flour in the middle of the gravy. And the reason is, you forgot to stir it. So it isn't like the lumps just happened. The lumps were there all along. And with your horse, if you don't stir it, the resistances are there all along. They're just under the surface. So when these things happen that she finds troubling, in a certain sense, she should be almost grateful because she has discovered what's wrong and she can fix it before she gets in the show ring. She can get the whisk out if she's in the kitchen. She can pick the right exercises to do if she's at home schooling. So when it counts, the judge doesn't see the lumps. So it's a little bit one of those canary in the coal mine situations. Resistances of themselves are not bad things. They're signs. The horse is waving to you saying, fix this. And so it gives you a place to go and work. There's another woman whom I teach, and she's a pretty decent first level rider going on second level. And she said to me one day, why is it just when you tell me my canter's being really good, my horse breaks? What about that? And I explained to her that that's because we're trying to expand the envelope. Her horse is perfectly happy cruising around on the forehand. It'll canter forever, but not look like a second level horse that way. So as you begin to ride more towards the edge of your horse's capability and a little bit more towards yours, of course you make mistakes. Mistakes also are normal and okay. That's how you make progress. Turns out there's a guy at Duke University in the civil engineering department who has written a whole lot about that. His name is Henry Petrosky, and he talks about something called the gain through error paradigm. And riding works that way too. You only notice that you need to do better when something goes wrong. And again, as much as you didn't need to worry about resistances, you can't worry about mistakes. Everybody who's good makes mistakes. Fortunately, they catch them, they make them early, they fix them, they go on and make another mistake, and they fix that. And that's the normal process of training horses, and also something in the new year that you don't want to worry about. That's something you're supposed to deal with. And then there's one other person I can tell you about. She came to me in a clinic, and she was kind of a hunt seat type rider, looked nice on a horse. Horse was pretty strung out, kind of marginal light contact, not much going on. And no matter what I asked her to do, nothing happened, nothing. And I would explain, nothing would happen. And finally, I called her in and said, "So tell me, you understand what I'm saying?" "Yes." "Okay. You understand why it's good for the horse, how it'll make him more comfortable for you to ride, and he'll last longer if you do these things?" "Yes." "Why aren't you doing anything?" And she said, "Because I don't want to look ugly." And I asked her to come closer because I didn't want to embarrass her in front of the audience watching. I said, "Well, here's the deal. You can look ugly for a second or two, or you're going to look really stupid in front of these people for a long time." And she's kind of just taken a little aback and began to ride. So I think you can tell from what I've been saying that I'm very in favor of proactive riding, not sitting there hoping it'll happen. It's like God shouting down, "Buy a ticket," that kind of thing, you know? That's the only way you progress. And having said that, I want to warn you about one thing that makes me absolutely crazy, and that's when a rider says to me, "My horse is only good when I get really mad at him." Well, yeah, that's, to me, that's just an incredible lack of self-awareness and self-control, because when you get angry, you lose your mental faculties of judgment. And riding, as we all know, isn't just a physical thing, it's a mental thing. And if you're not able to control your temper, then you make bad judgments and bad things happen. I play golf, kind of badly, but I play. And if you could imagine, I'm out on a fairway that's pretty narrow, it's got water down this side, it's got trees here, the wind's blowing sideways, and I'm going to pick a pretty conservative club and try to just hit the ball down the middle, have it in play to get to the green on the next shot. If I'm on a different tee and it's wide open and, you know, the rough's cut down real close, and if I hit it kind of errantly, I still have a shot. Then I get out the driver with a big long shaft and the head on it the size of a cantaloupe, and I can just wail the heck out of it. No matter where it goes, I probably still have a shot. But the point is, if I do it the second way, I'm not mad at the ball. I'm not mad at the club. It's an appropriate technique that makes sense to use then. I have a friend who's a surgeon, and most of the time she uses a scalpel. If she has to use a hacksaw or a mallet for some obscure procedure, she's not mad at the patient, and she's not mad at the equipment. It's what you use at the time, because that's what works, and right after that you go back to the refinement that the rest of the time you would use. If you can't control your temper when you ride, well, there are basically two choices. You have to learn to ride differently, or you need a different sport. And I have a suggestion for you. There's a sport which I discovered. You can Google it, it's actually true. It's an English pub sport called chess boxing. And you start out at the chessboard. For 4 minutes, you do speed chess, and the bell rings, and you lace the gloves on, climb through the ropes, and you just pummel your opponent for 3 minutes. The bell rings, and you climb back out to the chessboard, and you alternate back and forth until there's either a checkmate or a knockout. That would be the sport for you if you don't have the right control of your temper. So there was a guy who summed this up really well. He was a Chinese general and philosopher named Sun Tzu. He lived 500 years before Christ. He quoted the Buddha to his officers once, saying, "Remember, men, you will not be punished for your anger. You'll be punished by your anger." So, those are my resolutions for you. Take them all into consideration, at least. See if they don't fit in with your writing. And now we get to the quiz. Okay, this is the good part. All right, it's what do the following six people have in common? All right, the first one is the philosopher Albert Camus. The second is the novelist Vladimir Nabokov. Third, the singer Julio Iglesias. Fourth, the revolutionary Che Guevara. Fifth, Itzhak Perlman, famed violinist. And sixth, Pope John Paul II. No? No? All right. Well, turns out, earlier in their lives, they were all soccer goalies. And the reason that's interesting is soccer goalies, much like American pro football place kickers, are said to be on a team, but not of a team. They perform in splendid isolation. The team may have worked hard for 59 minutes, and it gets down to those last few seconds, and the spotlight's on the goalie or the place kicker to either win or lose the whole thing. And that reminds me a little bit about the way dressage works, too. I judged not long ago, in fact, and I kept a running tally of how many times groups of people were congregating at X during the tests, and not once. Splendid isolation. Anyhow, there has to be a reason that dressage riders are that way. I also noted that I went back and did some other research, and it turns out on their report cards when they were kids, that block about plays well with others, nope, not dressage riders. Loners. All right, so again, I did some research, and I don't know whether you are familiar with the name Frank Lesser, but he was a very famous Broadway composer back in the day. He wrote Guys and Dolls. He wrote How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And some well-known songs that if you don't know of them, probably your mother does or did. He was interviewed at one point because it turns out that back in the day, most of the time, people worked in pairs. You know, Lerner and Lowe, Rodgers and Hammerstein. But he did it all entirely by himself. The music and the lyrics, it was just him. And he got interviewed and they said to him, "So why is it that you work by yourself?" And he thought a moment and he said, I try to preserve the exclusivity of failure. And I kind of like that, you know? I said, yeah. So when you're walking back from the show office with your pink ribbon and your 55%, and your friends are all back at the stable and you've got to somehow justify yourself to them. The exclusivity of failure, yeah. But the thing is, if you say it with a little half smile on your face, next time you go in the show ring, you'll do better. So, all right, so that's my story. The only other things I want to mention are, I think the program indicated that I have a website. If any of this is remotely interesting to you, I blog on it. The things I've been telling you about are among the 350 blogs that are there archived. And there are also more than 100 questions of the month with answers to things lots of people want to know about. I'm more proud, however, about my online store. There are more than 40 items in my store, with pictures and descriptions of them. And the important thing about my store is none of the things in it exist. So if you want an abacus that mounts on your horse's withers so you can count your tempi changes, if you want a long dressage whip with a claw-handled back scratcher, that's in there. If you want a mounting block that's motorized and has a little chip that goes with the chip you put on your boot, so if your horse is moving around while you're trying to get on, the mounting block follows him until you get in the saddle. And the other thing that I like especially is, you know, those inflatable vests, like if you're getting bucked off. Well, the problem with them is you hit the ground. But mine has a helium canister. So when it pops, you simply float away. Your groom jumps in a golf cart with a bottle of champagne for the farmer, and you're in business. So thank you very much. After we're done, you know, this is the first day of the new tests, and if anybody wants to talk about them when we're done with everything, I'm happy to do that. So thank you very much.